Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hit it.
The mask fashion has been something.
This is the good news. It really has. I got to figure out the messages on the masks. Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart Daily, already in progress, where we help make today make sense. Do we, though? Why did we set this bar for ourselves? Kyrizol is out for one more day.
Who knew?
It really was. We thought it seemed... No, we started it with the pandemic because we were like, ooh, we need to be keeping track
the daily,
of this.
Well, the daily, yeah.
It's amazing. And the, yeah.
All right, hey, that's Kimberly Adams. That was just a fail on you and Kai's part.
I blame branding. It was such a good... You know what? It's aspirational. I'm going to think positive. It's aspirational.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We're going to do what we can to make today make sense. We said help.
Yes.
Help. Mm-hmm.
Yes. All
Kimberly,
those things are good.
So glad you're back again today.
Likewise. It's fun. It's been fun. And now you will have your beloved Kai back soon.
Oh.
That was a long pause.
It'll be great. I heard you coming back out my speakers and I had to turn it off. But yes, that is true. Kai, as we know, will be back tomorrow. He'll be back tomorrow. Hopefully just a rested, cheerful ball of joy.
Yes.
Don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In the meantime,
you won't be like such a Debbie Downer like I have been. Yes. News fix.
Stop.
Really?
You are not. We're going to do the news fix. We're
going to
make me smile. We're going to have an update on the pumpkin spice beer. But before that, apparently it's Debbie Downer time. Let's do it.
Wah, wah. Okay. So actually, it's... Is it a downer? I don't know. It's an amazing piece of journalism.
It's amazing.
It's an amazing piece of journalism. Of course, we're talking about the New York Times, 9,800 words piece on Donald Trump's taxes, the thing that everybody's been trying to get even before he became president. He said that he would release them. He didn't. There have been all these sort of reasons for why. The New York Times got a hold of them and just has this incredibly deep dive into Trump's taxes, what his business operations look like, how it may present some real conflicts of interest for his presidency, and how it's kind of set him up to have some real debts coming due in a meaningful way in the next couple of years, which could also, based on this reporting, present some real conflicts of interest. Now, of course, the Trump administration is calling this fake news, but on the other hand, responding to specific claims that are apparently true, it's a bit of a mix, but I know it's a lot. If you have the opportunity, please read the whole thing. It's so fascinating. And if you can't quite bring yourself to read the whole thing, there's several associated stories, one of which is sort of like a bullet points with the main takeaways. There's also a graphical representation of what they found in the tax returns that you can scroll through and see how it looks. It's really... important, I think, as a transparency thing.
Yeah.
And it will be very the Times apparently has more coming, and so it'll be very interesting to see what more comes out of this.
It really is remarkable. And it's so interesting because these particular tax records, more than any other from probably any other president in history, show all of the different ways that business can be a liability for a president. You know, whether it's the conflicts of interest related to countries in which he has done business or apparently paid more taxes, for example, in the Philippines than he paid in the United States, as well as that kind of mountain of personally secured debt. And to be clear, the tax records that, at least in the reporting we've seen so far, don't make it clear where that debt is coming from. And so a lot of people in the national security community on Twitter, at least, have been saying this represents a huge national, just having that much personally secured debt represents a huge national security threat. And then not knowing where it came from only compounds that. Plus, just as a matter of tax code, we're going to dig into that on tomorrow's Make Me Smart. Actually, we're doing a pivot on the fly because rich people and taxes in America is a very tangled web.
There are two other things that really jumped out to me about this. Number one was just all of the different ways that business interests can influence individual politicians through associated businesses. You had companies, you know, trying to rent commercial real estate from Trump organizations. You had people signing up in droves for memberships at Mar-a-Lago. You had people staying at the hotels and all of these things that can very easily translate into looking like trying to influence the president of the United States. The other thing that I just have to bring up, because you mentioned Twitter, was just how quickly the Biden campaign jumped on this. I mean, there are some burns on Twitter related to this story. They had a video that they put out automatically. They've got merch. They have these stickers that say, I paid more taxes than Trump did, which is most of us. Well, actually, no, I think most people get a refund. But anyway.
But still, a lot.
It's a lot. A lot. There's a lot on there that I will admit, like, you know, it's very partisan, but some of them made me chuckle.
It is. Well, yeah, I mean, it's gotten pretty. I'm sorry. The puns are amazing.
Some of the jokes are funny.
The dunks are amazing. Some of the jokes are funny. You know, I think the dunking probably, like, we know if we're being serious that the dunking obscures a larger point and several, but whatever.
Yes.
But it's still fun to dunk because that's what Twitter exists for. But I do think, yes, as a matter of campaigning, wow, did that happen fast. Like, you don't have the impression that the Biden campaign is that, I don't know, nimble. Quick on their feet, I guess. It was
they had to know something about, like,
social media.
I mean,
blitz.
I find it very hard to believe that they had no idea this was coming. Washington is
true.
A very small town.
Touche. Because, yeah, I'm like, wow, they spun up those stickers in a hurry. Yeah, it's go read it. Like, you really, you know what? The thing is, you deserve to know. So go read it. It's worth it. This is a downer, but it's fascinating and infuriating because the leaks just keep coming. Channel 4 in the UK actually got its hands on a massive data leak. Yes, I heard you. I have a thought.
Well, yes, it's just I feel like we should mention that Channel 4 is an incredibly respected news outlet in the UK. Considered really, really highly valued in terms of investigative journalism and kind of sticking it to their domestic politicians. So it's not like a tabloid in the UK that we're talking about here.
Yeah, thank you. That is a really important point to make. It is true. This is a very, very real news outlet, which has gotten its hands on a cache of data, basically a giant data leak that is was used by Trump's 2016 presidential campaign on almost 200 million voters. And the thing that it reveals is that the campaign appears to have categorized millions of Black Americans, 3.5 million Black Americans, as, quote, deterrence voters, i.e. voters that they wanted to stay home on Election Day. Now, it is not unusual for campaigns to identify voters they hope will not come out. But where this becomes a terrifying story of technology deployed against Americans at scale, after obtaining all of this data, using it to determine that 3.5 million Black Americans were deterrence voters, that the campaign wanted to stay home, they were able to target them with ads, precisely target them with advertising on social media. And one of the examples that they gave, yeah, I mean, they just basically they used advertising to suggest that Hillary Clinton would not be good for Black Americans to try to get them to stay home. And it, you know, this project was headed up by, for example, two senior members of the Cambridge Analytica team that are now working on the Trump 2020 campaign. the digital campaign had at that time involved a team from Cambridge Analytica. There is this idea that targeted advertising can be so precise that it can actually influence behavior in voting. It was the subject of a lot of debate during the Cambridge Analytica scandal. But what we do know is that, and, you know, from the pure kind of like technology conversation, leaving aside so many for the moment, leaving aside for a second all of the other aspects of this campaign, look, it's really time to have a conversation about targeted advertising. Full stop. Like, this is the kind of thing you cannot pull off at scale unless you have the ability to do that, let alone the fact that targeted advertising incentivizes, you know, a surveillance economy. It centralizes power amongst the companies that have the biggest troves of data, like Google and Facebook. And it allows people to live in a universe where they see ads that other people aren't seeing. There's a famous story about how Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party in the UK, his own party targeted him with ads so to convince him that they, the Labour Party, were actually pursuing a strategy that he wanted them to pursue. They weren't, but he thought they were because he saw their ads on Facebook. Because at some point on Facebook, you could target literally a person. Now you can. Now you have to target at least like 20 people. But it's so insidious and it's so dangerous and it's so, I don't know, unnecessary. And then this is basically this data leak proves to be the sort of worst case scenario of what we're talking about when we say that targeted advertising is like bad for everyone.
I mean, I will insert the, you know, required the Trump campaign says this didn't happen caveat. That's what they told Channel 4. But there's data. That targeted advertising thing is very interesting here in D.C. because often you end up in buildings or neighborhoods where government officials might live. And so sometimes you know how which particular lobbying group is really trying to sway Congress or a government agency because all of a sudden in one particular neighborhood, you know, you'll get these really targeted ads on cable news or online because the targeting is so good that it can get down to a neighborhood or block level and all of those things. And so, yeah, it's a lot. This targeting of I should say, I mean, I know we're running long on time, but you sent me this story today and it really struck me because I had a story on the PM show today about how campaigns are figuring out how best to spend their money at this tail end of the campaign and where you get the most bang for your campaign dollar. And one of the people I talked to said, yeah, there's a strategy that campaigns use where they spend money to convince people not to vote, just to stay home. And then you sent me this article and I was just like, oh my gosh, there's the data. It's right there. And, you know, people talk about these things in the abstract, but unless you're sort of really plugged in with a particular campaign and then they don't want to tell you and all these things. And then there's data. So there's that. It's grim. It's sad. But
it's grim. You know, we don't know if it works. I mean, I think the important thing to note, even during Cambridge Analytica, was we don't know if it works. There is not like widespread proof that it causes people to change their vote or stay home. But we do know that it's possible. And now, at least according to this leaked information, it suggests that it was carried out quite specifically against Black Americans, like disproportionately, which is obviously also deeply problematic.
I could use some other music now.
Right? Let's do it.
Molly, you brought us really, really down. You have to, like, recover from this, please.
I know. I'm sorry.
Please.
I think we got two good ones. I think we've got two good ones.
Yes.
Okay, well,
we got great ones.
Clearly, our audience knows me well because so many people sent this thing to me, which I had never heard of. But apparently, each year, or at least each of the last, like, 2 or 3 years, Katmai National Park in Alaska has an annual contest because, like, bears are headed into hibernation right now for the winter. And then what bears do to prepare for hibernation is eat a lot. get super, super fat. I know we're going to get emails and they're going to be like, actually, bears don't hibernate the way that we thought they'd. No, they don't go to sleep for 6 months. We're past that. But they do reduce their activity significantly and like take to the caves and whatever. And before they do that, they get hella fat. And so Katmai
Chonky
National Park has a thing, Chonky Bear, has an annual hashtag Fat Bear Week. And there's like a full-on matchup. There's a bracket. There's voting. They have all, their Instagram has all these pictures of, I mean, like absurdly gigantic bears.
Videos of them trying to catch salmon in all of their chonkiness, and it's glorious.
It is so glorious. I mean, like, really? At the end of the day, the only thing sometimes that will make you feel better is just like chubby animals.
Yeah, I wonder how Cinder
chonky
Block
bears.
Is doing.
They should change it to Chonky Bear. To Chonky Bear.
Yes, Chonky Bear.
It's just kind of delightful. Chonky Bear. It has brackets. It has brackets. Oh,
so who's
good.
who's your like prediction for who's going to win?
Oh man, that's a good one. I don't know. I gotta really dig into the data here. I need to go full Moneyball on this situation. I can't just like.
Can't just go on my gut.
That never works. No. Mm-mm, no.
Okay. Well, then. So I have a story that appeals to me in so many different ways. So as you know, I used to live in Egypt. One of the things that was very fascinating to me was that Starbucks was just like the place to go. You know, sure, people worked there remotely, but it was also like a place that people would go for dates. It delivered to your house. And it was just a much like bigger deal than your average neighborhood Starbucks in the U.S. However, Starbucks in the Middle East, apparently, at hundreds of stores this year, is not selling pumpkin spice latte.
Gun, gun, gun.
Dun, dun, dun.
What?
They wrote on their Facebook
page. Why is this a make me smile? It's a make me smile for people in...
It's
Middle
a
East,
make me
like,
smile for Kai, actually, because Kai is coming back tomorrow and I wanted something that would make him smile. So it's like predictive Aww. Make me smile for Kai. I was trying to do something
Where
nice.
Where to go? Said,
there you,
Where to flee to?
Well, I don't want to send Kai to the Middle East, but they said on their Facebook page, unfortunately, pumpkin spice latte won't be available this year due to business operations reasons. I don't know what that
means.
By
the way, that's like the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life. I'm going to start saying that too. I'm sorry, guys. I'm not going to be doing the tech show today due to business and operations reasons. Just not going to happen.
Speaking of pumpkin spice.
I know. What have I done? Okay, good news.
Well, congratulations.
Yes, congratulations, Marketplace. We hit the $100,000 goal. Hit it early. We were just trying to get to it by October 1st, which is Thursday. We hit it, which is awesome. Kai has to drink the beer at the end. Time to go.
Yeah, not so much. Not at all. So because we hit that goal early, we are not done yet. Now, since we have a few days left in the drive, we thought we might be able to keep the momentum going and raise perhaps $150,000. You get it? Like, we can raise the bar, like beer bar, raise
but,
the bar.
That's good.
I tried. Okay, anyway, we're increasing the goal to $150,000 by the end of the day on Thursday, October the 1st, which happens to be National Pumpkin Spice Day. And if we hit it, and this is why Molly is acting so shady, Molly will have to drink the beer too.
Yeah. I think everyone should have to drink the beer. I don't understand why we can't just spread the love. I don't like beer, as many of you know, except for Coors Banquet beer, like only the bad kind. Yeah, this is not fine. But, however, both of us are going to drink the beer. There's going to be video. It's going to be disgusting.
It's
most likely. I think my Twitter feed, the parts that are not Fat Bear Week, are all like people recommending different kinds of pumpkin spice beer, which is astonishing. I cannot believe that there are that many of them.
Some people really love their seasonal beverages.
Yeah.
Okay, we are like so far over. Anyway,
we really
the benefit
are. We really
of all
are. Okay.
Of this, the benefit of all of this is that the donations go to help producing Make Me Smart, where I know it sounds like we're doing nothing but having fun, which it is, but we're also really trying to help people understand the economy and make sense of the day. And so by donating to Marketplace, you're making an investment in trustworthy independent news that matters and hopefully means something to you. So please donate today at marketplace.org/givesmart, and let's force Molly also to drink pumpkin spice beer.
Somehow I'm going to get you to drink that beer, but yes, please do. Thank you. And thank sincerely and truly.
I'm only a fill-in.
Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like I can kill two birds with one stone here. Anyway, thank you to everybody who donated. It really is phenomenal. It's like, this is, I think, more money faster than we've ever raised it. And we are profoundly grateful. And let's keep it going. We will see you again tomorrow with our deep dive, which I said is going to be into the tax code. Politics aside, we really want to talk about how the ways in which it does and does not promote inequality, the myths and the reality of what is possible with this very uniquely American tax code. See you then. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Rose Conlon, and a huge welcome to Marissa Cabrera, our new producer, who starts today.
And who is a Mizzou alum like me.
Oh, hey. Oh, my goodness. I love it. Somehow we're going to get her to drink beer, too. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote is our video producer. Ethan Peretz is our video intern extraordinaire. Wah, wah, wah. And Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and the Make Me Smart skill on your smart device.
Today's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Our senior producer is Bridget Bodner, and the executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. Thanks for the fun run, Molly.
I know, it's been so nice.
See you soon. I'll see you on Slack anyway.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.